Seabrome Vault Podcast, episode number 399. Friday, May 21st, 2021.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey, everybody. So this is Seabrome Vault Podcast, episode number 399. Usually the first thing you hear, and it should be the case in this episode as well, the very beginning, I'll say, Seabrome Vault Podcast, episode number 399, and then I'll say the date. As I speak these words to you right now, it is 6:36 p.m. on Thursday, May 20th, 2021, but I haven't recorded the timestamp, which goes at the beginning yet, because, well, I don't think I'm going to get this podcast out tonight. This is a first run at it. So what's happening right now? I mean, I know some of you, you let these podcasts pile up for a while and then you listen to them in batches. So this week, the week ending, the last day of the Friday, tomorrow is the 21st of May. What happened in recent weeks? Well, Israel's kicking the shit out of... Really, it just seems like they're kicking the shit out of the civilian population in Gaza. But I do recognize that, you know, Hamas did launch rockets into Israel, not effectively targeted, just sort of lobbing them willy-nilly. You know, if this is so interesting to me, you know, I'm a big Andrew Yang fan, but like, I think a lot of the people who like him, I like his affect as much as I like any of his policy proposals. I like that he's, you know, he doesn't attack. He's not, he doesn't spew, you know, just political vacuous drivel. At least he didn't in the past. And he was leading comfortably in the New York City mayoral race until Hamas launched rockets into Israel. Israel massively, massively over-responded, punishing the Palestinian civilians, mostly in Gaza. And Andrew Yang issued a public statement which didn't ring like his voice. It just sounded like, you know, the political hackery of some hired consultant. You know, whenever something happens in Israel, you make this statement. And this is a statement that is just, this is total boilerplate for any Democratic politician. And I'm not even going to pull it up on screen. It was basically something to the effect of, you know, I stand with Israel and its right to defend itself. And then AOC attacked or criticized, we'll say criticized, singled out Andrew Yang for criticism for making this statement. This statement, which is identical to statements released by all the other, you know, mayoral candidates for New York City, identical in its content to a statement from Nancy Pelosi. In fact, it was much shorter than ones from Nancy Pelosi, but all the leaders of the Democratic Party, you know, issued statements, the standard de rigueur statements in support of Israel. It's what they do. And yet, Andrew Yang, who has never held an elected post, has no history whatsoever, bears no responsibility for the current U.S. support of Israel and the trajectory of U.S.-Israeli and Israeli-Palestinian relations. He bears no responsibility for any of that. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez chose Andrew Yang as the target for her ire about statements in support of Israel. And I don't hold Andrew Yang blameless here. I think by, you know, hiring the sorts of consultants who lead him to make statements like this, which make him sound like every other politician, he loses a lot of his authenticity and charm. He becomes far less attractive for sounding more like a traditional Democrat politician. And it's not just the Democrats who, you know, reflexively support Israel. I'm not making that statement at all. So, he's now no longer leading in the polls. He's doing well. He's certainly, you know, the number one or number two candidate, but he's not clearly the number one candidate like he was for so long. He may well lose. And, you know, in the grand scheme of things, maybe it's for the best. I don't know. I like the guy. I don't know that he's necessarily the best qualified to be the mayor of New York City. So what else is going on? Bitcoin. Wow. Bitcoin was up over $60,000. It's now sitting at around $40,000. When it started dropping, I thought I would buy the dip. And, you know, I don't have a lot of money to invest in Bitcoin. I bought like $20. But I bought before it bottomed out. So I have no doubt that it will recover to where it was before and go higher. But it may take a long time. I don't know. I've been listening to various, you know, commentators on YouTube talking about this. One of them, what's his name? Lark, something Lark. He's been talking about, you know, the causes for this. It's partially caused by Elon Musk. Tesla announced, well, Tesla bought a bunch of Bitcoin. They bought about $1 billion worth of Bitcoin, just, you know, because it was going up in value. It seemed like a smart thing to do. And Tesla was accepting payment for their cars in Bitcoin. But then Tesla last week, they issued a statement saying that they would no longer be accepting payment in Bitcoin because they had environmentally based objections about Bitcoin. So much electricity was used to create it. And they didn't want to support that by taking it as payment for their vehicles. And Elon Musk also intimated, he didn't say, but he intimated that Tesla had either sold all their Bitcoin or they were about to. Well, Tesla didn't hold enough Bitcoin to, you know, just by selling their Bitcoin to really affect the price all that much. But Elon Musk has enormous presence, particularly on Twitter, and people pay very close attention to what he says, and in many cases, drastically overreact to what he says. And so most of the people who are selling Bitcoin right now are not people who have been holding it since, you know, they bought it when it was denominated in hundreds of dollars rather than in tens of thousands of dollars. Anybody who bought it when it was less than $40,000, which is anybody basically who bought more than a year ago, they haven't lost any money yet. You know, they've seen some of the gains, the paper gains eroded by this recent crash, but they're not below their purchase price. Who's below their purchase price? Newcomers. People who got in because of FOMO, you know, fear of missing out. These are the so-called retail investors. And I learned that term with the GameStonk affair, you know, that the institutional players who were looking to crash the price of GameStop, you know, to sell it short first and then crash the price and reap the rewards. When the GameStonker, you know, when the Twitter people, what do they call themselves? The retards, not on Twitter, on Reddit, when they all got together and decided to buy the stock and buoy the price and thus screw the hedge funders, well, the corporate media in lockstep condemned them for doing so. And they were described as retail investors. And here, too, it is the recent newcomers to Bitcoin who bought it at the top, you know, bought it when it was like $60,000. And by the time it hit, you know, $55,000, they were panicking and they just started selling. Well, guess what? Somebody's buying all that. Who? If this Lark guy is right, it's big institutional investors. JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs. Big players with connections to corporate media who can, you know, along with Elon Musk, run stories to generate panics and manipulate the price of an asset so that they can destroy the price, buy it when it's cheap, and then pump it up again. Now, I know a lot of you listening to this are not only skeptical of Bitcoin, but, you know, you're actively hostile to it. This is something that libertarians are into, tech bros are into. You know, people in general who are not farming or building things or doing community organizing, they're sitting at their computers, typing away, trying to figure out how to make money from nothing. Fair enough. You know, feel free to cheerlead their, but you know, it's not the tech bros, it's not the investment bros who are getting screwed here. It's the FOMOers. It's the people who saw how much the asset was growing, didn't know a lot about it, but didn't want to miss out on this growth, and they dumped their money into it and then got screwed. But, you know, Bitcoin, I remember in the summer of 2017, very, very vividly, it was around $900. And I sold almost the last of my Bitcoin to buy a truck. And within weeks of me selling that Bitcoin, it went from about $900 to about $21,000. So that truck, for which I was supposedly paying around $1,800, was really a $40,000 truck. And, you know, that $21,000, that was the new all-time high. It seemed surreal. That was in 2017. Then it fell back down to, I don't know, like $6,000 or $7,000 or $8,000. It was below $10,000 after it hit that $20,000 peak. And that's where it started 2018, I think. So here we are 3 years later, and it's fallen to $40,000. And people are freaking out and saying that it's the end of the world. Or at least, you know, Bitcoin's going to zero. It's the end of the world for crypto. Maybe it is, but I doubt it. And I'm certainly not about to sell. Even though if I were to sell all of my Bitcoin now, one, I wouldn't get that much money for it because I don't have that much money in it. But two, I'd still be getting out with a net profit. Why would I be getting out with a net profit? Because when I sold almost all of my Bitcoin to buy the truck, there was a tiny, tiny, tiny little bit of what I had before left in my account on Coinbase. You know, it was basically Bitcoin dust on the floor that I didn't bother to sweep up into a dustpan and cash out. And that Bitcoin dust that I left on the floor in 2017 grew to be several hundred dollars as the price of Bitcoin was increasing. And that is the bulk of, you know, what I own now in Bitcoin. It's way, way less than one coin. And also, back in 2017, the Chinese Communist Party made some rules about what Chinese companies could and could not do with cryptocurrency. They basically just put some limitations on their own companies. Well, this past week, various news outlets, according to Lark anyway, have started to recycle that story as if it were a news story, as if China had just now announced new limitations on Bitcoin. You know, to reinforce this notion that, oh, the walls are closing in, it's all over for Bitcoin. So, stepping away from Bitcoin, but staying in the realm of the economy. Inflation is up. Why? Well, gold bugs and, you know, right-wingers who are always talking about the death of the dollar and how the financial apocalypse is coming tomorrow. It's always coming. You know, it's right at the door. It's almost here. They say it's because the U.S. has created so much new money in response to COVID, that this is driving inflation. Well, I'm going to offer up, you've heard me talk about Peter Zion before. I know some of you don't like him. He's written such books as The Absent Superpower, The Reluctant Superpower, and Disunited Nations. And he publishes a newsletter rather infrequently, but he sent one out this week talking about inflation. Before I read it, though, I'm going to read the whole thing to you. But before I do, I'm going to summarize a little bit of what Chad Hill, now Chad, what's he go by now? Chad C. Mulligan. He used to write the Hip Crime Vocab. Now he's got a Substack where he's continuing to write. He wrote a long piece about inflation. And some of the key pieces, I don't have it up in front of me. I'm not going to quote from it exactly. So I'm just going from memory. The things that stood out to me that were valuable from that piece that Chad wrote, I will link to it, though, so you can read the whole thing for yourself because it's worth a read. Also, Mark C., who is a participant on the Friends of the CROM. It's not the Friends of the CROM. It's just the CROM podcast discussion group on MeWe. He posted a link to it. That's how I found it. But some of the points that Chad made were, one, you know, we think of inflation as prices going up, but that's not the whole story, clearly. And it's not necessarily prices which are inflating. It's the money supply that's inflating. But even that's not a full accounting for what inflation is. Inflation really is a ratio. It's a ratio of purchases made to the money supply. You know, the money supply can go up and people's purchasing can also increase side by side and prices don't increase. You have technically inflated the money supply, but if the economy is growing, if spending is growing, you know, if supplies are not constrained, but, you know, there's not an oversupply, all things being equal, you can increase the money supply and not have an increase in prices. So we don't think of that period, even though the money supply is increasing, we don't think of it as an inflationary period. That's pretty important. More important, you know, people talk about inflation as if it's a bad thing, but neither inflation nor deflation is bad for everybody. Inflation is good for people who don't have a lot of money. It's very good for people who are in debt. Who's it bad for? It's bad for rich people. Inflation shrinks the value of their accumulated wealth. And at the same time, particularly if their wealth is derived from rent seeking, from like interest on loans, you know, if they're financiers, if they're credit card companies, inflation, you know, the diminishing power of your dollar also makes your debts smaller and easier to pay off. Whereas deflation, while it might feel really good to go to the store and see that things are getting cheaper, also means it's harder to pay off your debts. You have to pay back your debt in money which is worth more than the money you got when you took out the loan. He has a great line in there, and I'm tempted to go and find it just so I can read this line to you. In fact, I'm going to do it. Here we go. Through the magic of editing, you won't have to wait while I find the piece. Okay, I've found the piece, and it is, he's calling his Substack the Hip Crime Vocab still. The piece is called Inflation and Deflation Primer, A Few Facts About a Complicated Subject, and this is from May 15th. And only one person has clicked like on it. Let me fix that. Now, two people have clicked like. I've doubled the number of likes on this piece. Okay, so I'm going to read you two paragraphs. And before I do, apologies in advance to the boomers in the audience. And as I told Thaddeus Russell when I talked to him yesterday, I have a lot of boomers, you know. In terms of the total composition of the audience, it's an older audience. It skews older. And he was envious of that. I'm fairly envious of his, you know, his millennial listenership. But I've said before, I stand by it. We don't choose when we're born. We don't choose what messages we get fed as we're coming up. We don't know the future. Boomers look selfish and irresponsible in hindsight, as if they knew, you know, in the 60s and 70s, what we all know now about the trajectory of the economy and, you know, global politics, social trends. They didn't know. They had people like Timothy Leary blowing smoke up their ass, telling them they could do no wrong. And, you know, at a critical point in their lives, they lived in a time of high inflation and high interest rates, which was really good for them. Here's Chad Hill to explain why. Begin the quote. Put simply, high inflation erodes inequality. As Temeth Palihapitiya pointed out on Twitter, the highest inflation of the 1970s also coincided with the smallest ever gap between rich and poor in the U.S. economy. As Joe Wiesenthal noted, the 40-year obsession with fighting inflation has been a disaster for the poor and fantastic for the wealthy. All the boomers whining about the high inflation of the 1970s have it exactly backwards. High inflation made it easier to buy a house because so much of the debt was eroded by inflation, even taking into account the high interest rates at the time. Salaries also increased much faster than they do now thanks to high unionization rates and the emphasis on full employment. That is, their home loans were easier, not harder, to pay off than for subsequent generations. Yet they still like to complain about the high nominal interest rates in isolation from other macroeconomic conditions at the time. That's just dumb and wrong. Okay, boomer. End block quote. So, prices are going up. The money supply has increased. Can't deny it. One other distinction from Chad Hill or Chad C. Mulligan before I move over to the Peter Zion newsletter. Inflation decreases the value of your money. Hyperinflation destroys it. These are two very different phenomena. One is really bad for just about everybody, except, you know, parties outside of the affected economy. Whereas regular old inflation, which isn't hyperinflation, again, is good for people who don't have a lot of savings, who are not rent collecting, basically. And it's particularly good for people in debt. So now, The Inflating of Fears by Peter Zion. This is May 19th, 2021, so sent out just yesterday. Peter Zion writes, I'm going to attempt the impossible with this one, making economics not necessarily fun, but painfully relevant to someone who cannot work an Excel document. Here goes. The United States is experiencing the fastest increase in prices since at least the peak of the subprime boom back in 2008. In April, inflation was already up 4.2% from a year earlier, generating waves of criticism for the Biden administration, whose spending plans are credited with artificially spiking demand. Normally, the government aims to keep the annual increase below 2%. At first blush, I really don't see the April data as a big deal. Everyone remember what was going on a year ago? Coronavirus-induced lockdowns cratered demand, which meant that prices were falling quite a bit. This 4.2% increase from a year earlier is really just a reversion to the mean. But that said, yeah, it is going to get much, much worse over the next year or so. Arguably, the single biggest reason for the price increases is that Americans are getting out. The country is now majority vaccinated, and since COVID is a respiratory pathogen, it has more difficulty spreading when people are outdoors. Aside from the most introverted of the agoraphobes who have loved COVID lockdowns, everyone is jonesing to get out of their home this summer and to some version of normal. Market tightness will become particularly noticeable in food. Traditionally, half the food consumed by value is eaten outside of the home. A year ago, when the lockdowns began, there was simply too much steak and cheese and bacon and not enough flour and chicken and milk. Agricultural production and processing systems contorted to make the adjustment. Now everything is going the opposite direction. There isn't enough steak and cheese and bacon to support rapidly shifting demand patterns. Okay, I'm going to stop there. I'm going to continue in a minute. I just want to comment. First, on ambient sounds, it is a beautiful day. It is 80 degrees at like 7 p.m. here in Bellows Falls. And it is still light outside because it is summer. So everybody's riding around on their motorcycles. They're running their lawnmowers, driving their loud trucks. I mean, that's just how the men in this part of the country, you know, there's just no avoiding it. Secondly, I just want to paraphrase what Peter Zion has said in this past paragraph. In normal times, in terms of how much money people spend on food, half of what they spend on food is spent eating out, you know, at restaurants or drive-thrus or just, you know, not stuff you buy at the supermarket, take home, put in the fridge and pantry and then prepare for yourself, but stuff that you get ready to eat while out in the world. And typically the stuff that we eat out is different from the stuff that we eat in. So when the lockdowns just changed everybody's patterns of movement overnight, that also changed everybody's patterns of food consumption overnight. And the stuff that people would, you know, would order when they're eating out was in oversupply. There was more of it than was necessary. And stuff that people used to prepare food at home, there was less of it available than normal because people were eating more of that stuff than they normally did. So hogs, chickens, cows, they take time to grow. Same with the wheat, you know, that we grind up to make flour. There's only so much you can rush the production of these sorts of products. But the market adjusted. It conformed the supply to the new patterns of demand. But now the patterns of demand are flipping back to what they were before. And again, it's not an instantaneous transition. The suppliers of food products cannot instantaneously accommodate patterns of consumption, which can change dramatically in a short period of time. Peter Zion continues, energy is rapidly evolving to match, for reasons typical, atypical, and downright weird. There's a normal seasonal increase in demand as farmers start planting in March, and as spring breakers hit their hold my beer parties. That increase doesn't typically stop until autumn. So, cyclically, we're on the normal early part of the demand ramp up. And it is happening as Americans are starting to get back to their lives, and so are driving more. And we have summer car vacation season just around the corner that pretty much everyone is looking forward to. Hell, I am planning a road trip. I hate road trips, and yet I cannot wait. On top of that, we've had a few hiccups across the energy sphere. A container ship clogged the Suez Canal for a week, blocking about 10% of global energy flows. Texas had a freak freeze that took some 3 million barrels of crude production. over 20% of U.S. output offline for a couple weeks, along with all the downstream refining and petrochemical work that actually brings us usable products like plastics and diapers and tires and cosmetics and face masks. Russian hacker group DarkSide took down the Colonial Pipeline for nearly as long, interrupting gasoline flows to half the eastern seaboard. A new horrific COVID wave in India is threatening port operations, potentially impacting half the country's oil supply. Individually, each is an event of global significance. Together? Damn. Nor are Americans staying put. The boomers, America's largest ever generation, are moving to warmer locales as they retire en masse. The millennials, America's second largest generation, are moving away from the major coastal cities to places where they can afford single-family homes so they can raise their new families. No one wants to be in a bus or subway every day where they might be exposed to COVID. Collectively, mass relocations are adding huge demand pressures to any and all suburban locations, particularly those in the South, Southwest, and Mountain West. In the world of manufacturing, the pressure is even greater. On the demand side, we've seen a lot of sloshing around this past year as people in waves decide they all need new computers or phones or home additions or furniture. We've not seen this level of erratic consumer behavior in the modern era. The world of global manufacturers simply cannot keep up, and retooling to meet demand in one area almost by definition means insufficient supply for another. The issue of the current quarter is surging demand for electronics has meant there are not enough semiconductors available for automobile manufacture. And I will break out of the reading here and just add to that, as a consequence of there not being enough chips, basically, computer chips, you know, to supply the demand for new cars, there is noticeable price increase in used cars. Used cars cost more right now because there's an insufficient supply of new cars because there's an insufficient supply of semiconductors for chips. And all cars, all cars are computerized cars these days. Peter Zion continues, "The broader supply side is a more national issue. American firms, rightly spooked by disruptions, physical, political, and medical, are relocating many of their supply systems to North America to insulate themselves from global disruptions. The shale revolution has made energy costs locally lower than they are globally. While the U.S. workforce's high productivity has made most manufacturing processes cheaper to operate in North America than East Asia. Of course, the industrial plant first needs to be built, and that absorbs just as many material inputs as expanding the housing stock. There's also a big risk on the near horizon. If the Biden administration's signaling bears out, the United States will be boycotting the 2022 Winter Olympics in Beijing. That will turn what is an ongoing trade cold war into a full collapse of economic relations. Every American firm operating in China will need to decamp, either because the Chinese confiscate everything as punishment or because their competitors start slapping them with the label "sponsors of the genocide Olympics." We probably are only seeing the tip of the proverbial iceberg in terms of relocation-driven manufacturing price pressures. So far, Americans don't care about the price increases, and they aren't likely to soon. If you fear the subway, you will pay a premium to not have to use it. If you do not want to shovel snow, you will pay a premium to not have to do it. If your home improvement project is already three-quarters finished, you will pay a premium to complete it. If your new home office has demonstrated to you that you need a better set of headphones and a newer computer, you will pay a premium to get them. If you have not eaten out in a year, that first time out, the first 20 times out, you're going to have yourself a damn steak. Personally, I find myself in four of these five categories, and in my shiny new snowblower, I'm in 4.5. Last year, Peter Zion moved from Texas to Colorado. He continues, "In the remainder of 2021 and throughout 2022, the United States will experience the highest levels of inflation since at least the 1970s. And if relations with the Chinese really do tank, the United States will be looking at World War II levels of price increases. American citizens can afford it. Multiple federal bailout programs by two presidents have put cash in pockets. Americans now have record cash on hand. One often missed aspect of the most recent COVID mitigation plan is to nearly double the child tax credit and make half of it prepaid in monthly installments. Those checks start reaching Americans July 15th. American companies can afford it. Those bailout programs benefit American firms just as much as they benefit the American people, arguably more in some cases. Without them, the airlines would have had to ground over half their fleets, and we wouldn't be nearly half as far along on retooling our industrial plant. Even small firms like ours have benefited. State support not only helped us maintain the staff we've spent 15 years building, but even expanded a bit. Incidentally, we hope to have our disaster assistance loan paid back this calendar year, but regardless, everyone say hi to our new researcher. Collectively, this government spending expansion is the largest since World War II, and it is not the story's end. The Federal Reserve has expanded the money supply to purchase government debt to pay for all the new spending, as well as to purchase bonds on private markets to backstop everything from city spending to corporate spending to the mortgage market to student debt to credit cards. And this next paragraph is in parentheses. Open parentheses. For those of you who obsess about Fed actions as harbingers of American apocalypse or vanguards of the imminent dominance of Bitcoin, curb your enthusiasm. Yes, the Fed has expanded M2 by roughly one-fifth since COVID began to just shy of $20 trillion, and yes, that is clearly inflationary, but first, over half that increase was in the first month of COVID. That was over a year ago now, and no apocalypse. Second, the U.S. economy is bigger than $20 trillion, and the U.S. dollar is the world's primary method of exchange and primary store of value, so a moderate monetary expansion just doesn't get my motor running. Third, and most importantly, the Chinese have expanded their money supply to $35 trillion despite their economy being smaller than America's, and very little of the yuan supply is being traded internationally. Please, obsess about the right thing and adjust your forecasts and plans accordingly. Close parentheses. Between the breaking of a year-long claustrophobic containment and government actions, Americans are gobbling up a whole lot of everything. Rising prices reflect all this. This does not mean the price increases don't matter, and I'm not limiting the things that matter to the normal bugaboos of inflation as regards spending capacity, wealth generation, debt levels, income stress, and midterm economic growth trajectories. The country, the world, is changing, and inflation is hitting us all a bit differently than before. First, a lot of jobs that existed pre-COVID are simply gone. COVID gave many firms no option but to automate away as many man-hours as possible. McDonald's and Pizza Hut have practically turned into Sonic. Now that the recovery is underway, but income support has not stopped, folks who used to earn less than $16 an hour are either waiting for benefits to run out or looking for jobs with better compensation. That's nudging employers with lower pay positions to automate more. Most of what few of those jobs might have survived COVID will not survive the recovery. COVID also encouraged online shopping to a degree and for a duration which suggests most retail locations will simply not recover. The jobs lost in the retail sector are among people on the low end of the income spectrum, disproportionately impacting women, blacks, and Hispanics. The most impacted individuals are those who have the lowest education levels and the most difficulty adapting to changed circumstances. They are also the people least able to function in a higher inflation environment. America's inequality issues are on the cusp of becoming far, far worse. We can look forward to that being reflected in American politics throughout this next political cycle. More Trumps, more Sanders. Second, the inequality issue isn't simply within the United States, but between the United States and the rest of the world. The United States will largely be finished with its vaccination program in about a month, enabling it to experience the fastest economic growth of its history. We're talking in excess of 10% annually. That's China doping statistics sort of growth. The United Kingdom and Israel are finishing their vaccinations on a similar timeframe. Vaccine diplomacy from Washington will soon flood Canada and Mexico with more than enough doses to enable them to join the party by the end of August. Europe is unlikely to join until at least the fourth quarter, more likely year's end. And that's about it for now. The vaccine formulas that work, and that the U.S. will soon have an excess of, Pfizer and Moderna, require two shots and primarily freezer storage, making both broadly unsuitable for the developing world. For most of the world's population, mass vaccination cannot begin until 2022, and it will be at a much slower rate than we have seen in America. The timing of all this is beyond unfortunate. Most of the world's investment capital comes from people who are on the cusp of retirement. They're shoving every spare dollar, euro, pound, or yen they have into their retirement savings. Once they flip into retirement, they never add to their nest egg again. Collectively, the boomer generation of the world is the largest generation our species has ever generated, and they, on average, retire next year. Capital has never been as easy to access or on cheaper terms as it will be in this calendar year. America and a few other lucky countries are experiencing this capital surge and record growth at the same time. Such a happy confluence of events is the sort of thing that enables firms and governments to lay down development efforts that will last for decades. I may have a boatload of reservations about all the new spending the Biden administration wants to launch, but I have to admit, if it's going to happen, the time is absolutely now. For the rest of the world, they are missing the last global capital boom of our lives. Most of the global boomer cadre did not have kids, which means as they age, they will instead absorb capital from their respective systems in the form of higher health care and pension costs, while never again paying into those systems. Those costs of capital won't simply increase by the end of 2022, they'll skyrocket. For those of you who don't understand what skyrocket means, increasing the interest rate on your mortgage loan by just 1% means increasing your monthly payment by 20%. Now apply that to everything: car loans, credit card debt, municipal bonds, the federal debt, everything. By the time the rest of the world emerges from under the pall of coronavirus, it'll be too late. The United States, France, and New Zealand are the only exception to these patterns in the advanced world. The boomers in those three countries had kids. They're the people that we know as the millennials, the oldest of which are now 42. Their consumption is keeping these three systems ticking on, and in about a decade, American, French, and Kiwi millennials will become major savers and investors, and they will, bit by bit, regenerate the capital stock of their respective countries. But there are not appreciable numbers of millennials in any other advanced nation. Add in that the vast bulk of the developing world has experienced baby busts more traumatic than anything that's happening in the developed world these past 5 decades, and this is pretty much it for capital supplies globally. Folks, this is it. Globalization is over. Even if the Americans decided that they wanted to continue to patrol the world, even if the Americans could keep making the world safe for international trade, global demographics and global capital tell us the page has already turned. Global aging meant that global consumption and investment was always going to collapse this decade, and then coronavirus moved the end forward. Most countries will never recover economically to where they were at the beginning of 2020, when the health crisis struck. And now, countries must deal with the intertwined nightmares of a collapse in global consumption, rising economic nationalism in the small handful of countries that retain decent demographic structures, and a high inflation environment triggered by the American recovery. For me, at least, this simplifies the math. My next book project, scheduled to publish in 2022, was originally going to thread the needle of how various economic sectors will function in the transition from a globalized world to a deglobalized world. History apparently has other ideas. It has now sped up. We've retooled to focus on life after the end of the world, which, now that I'm reading it aloud, might make a pretty good title. All right, that is the end. Again, that was from Peter Zion, the author of many books. Well, not many, really just 3 books. The most recent of which is Disunited Nations. All righty, well, it is now Friday. The sound of the ringing telephone was actually my mother calling. I talked to her for quite some time, and I did not get back to the podcast that night. So I just listened to and edited the reading I did of the Peter Zion newsletter, and one thing I noticed that he didn't mention was that all of this liquidity, you know, from all of this newly created money that the central banks of not just the U.S., but other countries around the world are flooding into their economies, is that a lot of that money is going to prop up asset prices, which is to say to keep the value of rich people's assets valuable. Also to create all kinds of bubbles. And at the risk of reading too much to you in one episode, I'm going to read just a little bit from a Bloomberg article. This is from back in January, January 24th. This is by Enda Kuran and Chris Anstey. And the title is Pandemic-Era Central Banking is Creating Bubbles Everywhere. Cheap money provided by central banks has been inflating assets and reshaping how we save, invest, and spend. So what's next? In Hong Kong, crypto trader Sam Bankman-Fried stole naps on his office beanbag to get through 18-hour days as demand surged for digital assets. At an auction in Wellington, Daryl Harper pronounced the New Zealand housing market ferocious as he brought the hammer down on homes going for hundreds of thousands of dollars above their official valuations. In Makati City, the Philippines, AC Energy Corp Chief Financial Officer and Treasurer Corazon Dizon was overwhelmed by the appetite for a $300 million green bond. And in Midtown Manhattan, hedge fund manager David Einhorn marveled over a job application from a 13-year-old who claimed he'd quadrupled his money. A common thread runs through these scenes from the plague year of 2020. Cheap money, gushing in from the world's major central banks, inflated assets and reshaped how we save, invest, and spend. That's not the end of it. Unlike past recoveries, when investors had no clarity on when the money taps would be tightened, this time officials have explicitly said they're going to stick to those loose policies well into a post-COVID recovery. The strategy is clear and deliberate. Snuff out volatility from the bond markets and make debt the cheapest it's ever been to deter saving and encourage investment. The hope: cheap cash leads companies to invest and hire as rising asset prices make people more confident and ready to spend. The inevitable side effect: more volatility for assets, apart from bonds, as investors chase returns around the world. And of course, the risk: bloated asset prices pop, undermining financial stability before the real economy can benefit from all that cash. Quote, there is no escaping that if you enhance liquidity dramatically, the money will go in search for yield and certainly can expose assets to mispricing, close quote, says Augustin Karstens, general manager of the Basel, Switzerland-based Bank for International Settlements, the so-called Bank for Central Banks. Quote, this is a risk and something that needs to be recognized and that needs to be watched very, very carefully, close quote. Signs of bubbles are everywhere, as stock prices jumped by a magnitude not seen since the dot-com era. New share listings boom, and Bitcoin, though volatile, continues its generally upward climb. But if company earnings fall short of expectations or the vaccine rollout falters, there's a risk markets will lurch as investors take money off the table. So this continues. I'm not going to read any more from it, but I'm stopping here because, you know, it touches back on Bitcoin, which is something that I mentioned earlier. A lot of these retail investors have money in their pockets, you know, that they got from the stimulus payments or from enhanced unemployment payments. I really didn't have my ducks in a row this year in terms of really, you know, taking advantage of all the money the government was giving away, although I did get a small business loan to upgrade my tech. But yeah, there's a lot of money sloshing around. And it does create distortions and weird effects, like, you know, that super run-up in the value, or at least the price, of Bitcoin. I recognize some of you think it has no value at all, regardless of how much you can sell it for. So something that Peter Zion touched on in the end of his essay there, or his report, is the United States, New Zealand, and France. Their baby boom generations remembered to have kids. And so we have a large millennial generation in the US, in France, and in New Zealand, but nowhere else. Everybody else forgot how to have kids. And that presents some real challenges for the countries which have an increasing number of old people, retired people, no longer working productive people, in relation to the number of young working people. Which is not to say that, you know, a person's value is defined by what they contribute to the economy, but as Peter Zion mentioned in the end of that piece, as somebody is getting ready to retire, they're saving as much as possible, they're putting as much into their retirement funds as possible, you know, they're making investments, but safe investments, you know, not in anything volatile. But then as soon as they retire, unless, you know, they're rich and they're generating more investment income than they're actually spending to support themselves, that's it. From that moment on, they're not contributing economically anymore. Old people don't consume like young people. They don't travel as much. They don't go out to bars, you know, they don't spend as much on clothes. They're not looking for, you know, new electronic gadgets for the most part, not the way that young people are. Young people are spending machines. Old people, not so much. Now, what's more, right now, over the last couple of years, life expectancy in the United States has been dropping, but not because people who make it to old age aren't living as long as they did a few years ago. It's that a lot of people are dying young from drug overdoses and, you know, other so-called deaths of despair because of the shitty economy. And I guess it's not really, you know, unequivocally a shitty economy. It's good for some people. But, you know, the increasing disparity between the wealthy and the not wealthy, and the continually dim prospects for, you know, normal people to get jobs that provide them with a dignified lifestyle and economic security, you know, as the 20th century boom in the middle class subsides back to rich people and struggling people with very few in the middle, medical science keeps marching on. And I'm looking at an article. This is from Barclays Bank. So a British bank, which took a, I think, several hundred million dollars slap on the wrist a few years back because they admitted to, you know, laundering drug money. But of course, none of the executives went to jail or sacrificed any amount of their quality of life in terms of their, you know, their standard of living. I'm looking at an article that they've put out, or a report that they've put out, talking about the effects of aging populations, but also of populations where people are living longer and longer. And there's a huge question. Like, there's a chart here that shows the relative life expectancies of baby boomers versus Generation X versus millennials versus Generation Z. That's my kids, Generation Z. And each generation looks like it's projected to live longer and longer, with Generation Z, you know, topping out around 105 years of age. Very few people, you know, make it to 100 years these days. A very, very small percentage of the population. But even without radical life extension breakthroughs, just the cumulative, you know, slow pace of accumulated life expectancy that we've seen over the past few decades, young people can be expected to live a very long time. So there's a huge difference. Suppose it was never intended, you know, when Social Security was set up, for example, it was never intended that somebody would work from, say, age 20 to age 65 and then retire and spend the next 35 years in retirement, you know, and live to 100 years old. That was not what that was not the intention of the modern day, you know, pension plan or Social Security plan. But there's a couple different scenarios. I mean, one scenario is you just have old people in an infirm condition who just linger for much longer than they would have in the past. Or you have people staying mobile and vigorous much longer. In the first instance, economically, that's a disaster. In the second instance, it might require that we change our conception of, you know, the stages of life. Like the 20th century life cycle. Has the first 20 years of your life marked out as childhood, where you're in school, you're getting trained, you're getting ready to be an adult and enter your working life. And then from ages 20 to 65, you're just an adult and you're working. And then from 65 to about 80, you're in retirement. But suppose the new standard life expectancy is 100 years old, and the ages 65 to 80, you're still pretty vigorous. You know, you're still mobile and self-reliant and certainly capable of working a job. Well, this Barclays report has this chart that shows the childhood adult retirement model of the 20th century above and below the 21st century life cycle that has the first 20 years of life are called childhood. And then there is this period, it looks to be about 10 years from ages 20 to 30. It just says young adults. The young adults, it describes them, you know, that period as gap years, traveling, and entrepreneurship. And then when your entrepreneurial efforts fail for the last time at around age 30, you've thrown the towel and just get yourself a job. But this next section, which, you know, in the 20th century model would have been called adulthood, here is called career one. And then at age 60, there's about a 10-year gap, maybe a 7-year gap, you know, the this timeline is in increments of 20 years. So I'm just having to guess, you know, how much anything smaller than 20 years is. But there's this interval after career one that just says career break. And after you've spent a few years in career break, you enter into career two, which takes you to about age 80, which is, the you know, in the 20th century, that was about the time you could expect to die. But in the 21st century, you know, particularly later in the 21st century, you could easily have another 20 years left. So that last 20 years, from 80 to 100, this Barclays chart says, you know, it labels that period as retirement. Economically, those two different scenarios, extended lifespan but not extended vigor, very hard to cope with. The more retired people you have relative to the number of working people, the more the people who are still working and paying taxes have to pay from their salaries to support the people who are no longer contributing, at least no longer contributing financially. We all love our grandparents, you know, those of us who have living grandparents. I don't anymore, but I certainly loved them all, you know, for the time that they were here, even when they weren't, you know, from a Barclays Bank perspective, productive. But for bankers and economists, this ratio of working people to retired people is called the dependency ratio. And right now in Britain, it's like 3.7 working people to one retired person. By 2040, it could be 2-1. As that dependency ratio increases, you know, on the dependent side, you get an increase in government spending on healthcare and pensions. You get higher taxes for working people. Economic sectors, you know, sectors within the economy tend to reorganize to start to cater to that much larger elderly population, particularly since a lot of the people with money are going to be in that population, although a lot of people in that population will also be broke. But you also get, you know, reduced capital investment, because as Peter Zeihan says, once you're retired, you're not saving for retirement anymore. You're not making investments anymore. You're not paying as much in taxes, and you're not earning as much. In purely economic terms, you become a drag on your society. Now, you know, the rosy scenario is not only do people live longer, but they stay vital and productive longer. Invariably, though, some people are going to get the 20th century lifespan, and they'll probably die at their desk. They won't get to see retirement because they will die at about the time people died in the 20th century. And, you know, that's when in the 21st century, people will still expect it to be winding down their second career. Although so many people never have anything that they could call a career. They just have jobs. Just stuff they do to make money with no prospects for promotion, no prospects for, you know, any sort of cumulative advancement or benefit. Just you work and every couple of weeks you get a check and you use that check to pay the rent and buy groceries and pay for insurance and put gas in your car. An extra 20 years of that, not anything I'd really be looking forward to. But what Barclays is not getting at here, and which I think is just as important, is the psychological character of an aging society. Young people are the risk takers. I look back on how I was, what my attitude was when I was in my 20s and 30s. I was a lot sharper. I could think a lot faster. I had a better memory, but I was also more adventurous. I took more risks. And I'm not unique in that respect. Societies that are getting top-heavy with older people tend to be very conservative. I don't want to say timid, but, you know, what's the opposite of risk-taking? And as people get older, they are less and less likely to revisit their long-held ideological convictions and opinions, which is to say that an older society is one that is stuck in its ways, less adaptable, less able to take advantage of changes in technology, new economic forms, new social trends. But, you know, who knows? I mean, if we really want to spin the bright side of it, the dependency ratio, no problem, we'll have robots to do that work. On the people not revisiting old opinions, you know, as they get into their advanced years, new drugs, you know, new therapeutic treatments to help us keep young of mind as well as young of body. I'm not looking to trade peak oil doom for demographic doom here. I'm not saying that our doom is deemed. I'm just saying, careful what you wish for. You know, in my time in the peak oil subculture, which overlaps heavily with the ecological and, climate activist subcultures, there's a lot of hatred of humanity. And there's a lot of wishing for, if not the extinction of the human species, that, a dramatic drawdown in the numbers of humans on Earth. And this is what it looks like. A lot of old people, few young people, and economic consequences that are not pleasant to deal with. And increased inequality. You know, the wealthiest people will be in that older set. Again, not all older people will be wealthy. Most won't be. But most of the wealth will be locked up in that age bracket. And a lot of people won't take that, mid-career break and then move on to career two. They'll just stay in career number one and not make room for younger people to enter into that field. All right, I'm going to stop here. I'll just say, I hope you detect no efforts at predicting the future in what I'm saying here. I'm mostly trying to make sense of the present and the recent past. Predicting the future, I am just absolutely confident, is beyond my abilities, and any successes that I have in that venture will be pure luck. But if you feel like predicting the future, what do you think's coming? And the more, I don't want to say the more short-term your predictions, the better, but the shorter the horizon on your predictions, the easier it is to grade your prediction, to see whether it came true or not, and the sooner we can talk about it. As always, send me email, comment on the CRUM podcast discussion group on MeWe or on Patreon. I understand that the Friends of the CRUM group on Facebook still exists, although I have no access to it, but, speak amongst yourselves there. And do join me on Tuesday. For most of you, I think, in the U.S., it's going to be Tuesday afternoons. For me, it's early evening, 5:30 p.m. to about 6:30 p.m. I do a live stream from the TV station here in Bellows Falls, and that is on my YouTube channel, Out of My Head. If you can't find my YouTube channel, send me an email, and I will send you the link. All right, that is all. I will be traveling this weekend with a friend of the CRUM whom I've never met, but I've spoken to him for a couple hours on a live stream once, so it's not like I'm, I don't know anything at all about him. And we'll be headed to Maine to see another friend of the CRUM, Mark C., whom you've heard on this podcast. So I plan to record a fair amount of material over the coming weekend and dole it out to you over the next couple of weeks. And I know there's not a lot of people in Maine, so it's unlikely that you fit this category, but if anybody listening lives anywhere near Bangor, Maine, and you want to hang out on Saturday, let me know. All right, I'm out. Talk to you again soon. Stay well.